Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Appreciate it. I can talk really fast sometimes, so if I'm talking too fast, just wave your hand and I'll slow it down a bit. So great to see so many faces here, so many friends of past lives. Great. Still weird in public settings. Getting used to it since the pandemic. So talking about community-based solutions, I'm going to talk a little bit about what Main Street Project does, because I think some people know some of the things we do, but usually not everyone knows all the things we do. So I think it really helps to ground it in the conversation. And then I'll also talk about kind of the situation, what we see from our lens in Winnipeg right now, and then what are kind of the solutions or path forwards towards solution that we see. So Main Street Project, it was our 50th anniversary last year, so we've been around for 50 years, and the core of what we've always done is just be there, meeting people where they're at, helping people who are on the street have a safe place to go. And you know, 50 years ago it started with, you know, Clay and John Rogers driving the streets and picking people up and bringing them back to shelter, and now it's a little bigger operation than it used to be, but still the same premise, right? Like, still the same work in the same way kind of the whole time. So we offer emergency shelter services. So we have the former Mitchell Fabrics building is our shelter, and we have a 120-bed shelter facility there. We operate a 24/7 sleep service, so people always have a place to come and sleep if they need that. And then we provide all those basic needs, food, clothing, showers, all the stuff you need, care, love, all in our shelter environment. And then we have comprehensive case management services built in throughout all of our programs, but shelter is kind of the biggest area where we have our case management team supporting, looking at rapid rehousing, supporting folks' stabilization. And then one thing we're known for is kind of being the lowest barrier place that folks go. So often folks who maybe don't fit in other places end up at Main Street Project. And so we usually say we're often the last place people are at before they're on the streets and the first place they are off the streets kind of thing. We run a van outreach program. So we have a van on the road 24/7, dedicated to supporting unsheltered folks wherever they're at. Do a lot of work with folks who live in encampments, folks sleeping rough, providing resources and support. And we always have a case manager in the van as well to do rapid rehousing directly out of encampments or on the streets, so that folks don't have to go through any systems to find housing. They have that direct support there as well. We offer withdrawal management services or detox services for the city of Winnipeg. So it's a free service. We have two locations, one for men and non-binary folks, one for women non-binary folks. And that's a 14-day withdrawal management service program. So anyone, not just folks who are homeless, come through that program. And it's often people's first step towards recovery or accessing treatment or care. That's not a requirement of our withdrawal management, so folks can come in regardless. So a lot of folks who aren't quite ready for recovery but know that their substance, problematic substance use is a problem, they can come into our program, go through the 14-day program, and then kind of not be required to go into treatment if that's not where they're at in their journey. So we really try to make it so that we can support you where you're at, and you can come through our programs as many times as you need, and we've seen the success in that. I know just the other day we had the story of a guy that went through 20 times, and it was the 21st time that he went through that he got into treatment, and it's worked, and now he's stable and housed and all that stuff. So it's always making sure our doors are always open regardless when you need us. We run two housing programs. So we run what we call mainstay housing, which is our transitional housing. So it's 28 units, 36 beds of transitional housing. And that's housing to support people kind of who may have challenges just fitting in a private rental or a mantle housing kind of type setting and need a little bit of support. So we provide three meals a day. We have healthcare on site. We do a lot of kind of life skill training in our mainstay building. And so we find that it's really good to be able to move folks, you know, right out of an encampment into mainstay and then give them that time to kind of stabilize, get used to kind of being, you know, inside again or whatever that might be, and then connecting them with resources and supports so they can move to more permanent or supportive housing. And then we run the Bell Hotel, which is on Main Street. I'm sure everyone's seen it. And that's our supportive housing building. That that is a great partnership. You know, Center Venture owns the building. They renovated it. Winnipeg Housing manages the maintenance, so we don't have to do that. I hate building maintenance. It's the worst part of my job. and then we do the people stuff. So we have staff there 24/7. The Bell is supportive housing's permanent, so folks can live there for as long as they want. And we have staff there 24/7 to support folks with their needs. We run the intoxicated person detention area, so that's anytime anyone is picked up by the Winnipeg Police, intoxicated in public, they'll be brought into our care. The custody gets transferred from the police to our staff, and then we support with a safe sobering process, and once people are sober, they can go back out into the community. And then we've been running COVID isolation for almost 3 years, just over 3 years now, and so we've been running a COVID isolation unit. At the peak of the pandemic, we had apartment block and two hotels, and now we're just back to one apartment block. So we're still running isolation. It's still operational until the end of May at least, and then who knows? I'm not going to try to predict the pandemic in any way. So what's happening in Winnipeg right now? So we have a major housing crisis. I'm sure most people are aware of, but if you're not, we do have a major housing. We're losing more units of supportive and affordable housing than we are building, and so that's a major crisis. Access to places like Manitoba Housing and that is slow and long to get in, long wait lists, and so that's fueling the challenges we're seeing in terms of the need for shelters and other emergency services to fill the gaps. We're dealing with probably the worst toxic drug supply we've ever seen in Winnipeg, for sure, if not right across the country. And so that's making challenges for anyone, problematic or non-problematic substance use. Not knowing the supply of your drugs means you're at way higher risk of overdose, of not knowing what's in your drugs, and so there's a major concern, and we don't have the supports to support people through those major crises, and so the toxic drug supply is fueling lots of social problems in the communities, creating situations of potential violence and other concerns that kind of fuel off that crisis. And then this isn't new, but system failures are really why organizations like Main Street Project exist. Systems are not accountable for what they are doing, and they often just exit people into homelessness or really precarious situations. And so, it's easy to look at the healthcare system as the first. We've just been through the biggest challenge I think our healthcare system's ever faced, and we didn't do a great job. And so we're seeing those healthcare system failures. In our community that we see people not even wanting to access a hospital service. So they'd rather stay in shelter and be in very poor health than going to a hospital for health and health supports. And a lot of that is based in kind of the systemic racism that exists within our healthcare system and other kind of systemic historical effects of colonization, on our community specifically. And so we see people not wanting to go to the systems that are designed to help people be healthy, right? And so that's a big challenge. The justice system is obviously not working. and so, that the big challenge is the number of people that are getting exited from justice systems into homelessness or into other emergency services, and there's no accountability in those systems to do anything to make sure people are not exited. Like if you're coming out of jail, you should be exited into a home. And so if that's not happening, then the system is really failing its responsibility. And then all the kind of social safety net systems as well, our employment income assistance program, residential tenancies, all those programs that are set up to support people, you need a ton of agency and capacity to be able to even navigate those systems. And if you don't have that level of agency or capacity, you just get abandoned by those systems very quickly and easily. So that's kind of the lay of the land as we are now. And then in terms of shelters and homelessness, we've seen throughout the pandemic, we saw the largest investment into shelters that we've ever seen in the history of our province. And that's not a great thing. We don't want to, you know, we run shelters. We always say we don't want shelters as a solution. It's not. It's an emergency service, but we've seen the number of shelter beds balloon now. I think it's any given night in Winnipeg, we have about 700 people staying in a shelter bed, emergency services, and that's kind of at the system capacity, and we're not seeing much fluctuation in that capacity either. We're always kind of full all the time. So what are solutions to these very complex challenges? And I'm not going to pretend like I know all the answers or solutions. I just know what I know and the work we do. But the key to our work at Main Street Project is always meeting people where they're at, coming in a non-judgmental way, and being there for people no matter where they're at in their, you know, in their life journey, in their recovery journey. Our goal is just to be there for people and support what they need in whatever way that is. We need to treat human beings like human beings, and systems so often remove that from the work, and we're trying to put it right back in that people need, everyone should be treated with respect no matter where they're at in their place in life. And providing, you know, care, love, support, connection, and fun. Like, we try to make everything we do while we're dealing with very challenging, complex, sometimes very tragic things, we try to make sure that we come out of a place where you can bring fun and joy and happiness to the work, because if you're not able to do that, then you're really failing the people you're serving. Housing. So the only solution to homelessness is housing. There's no other magic bullet, so unless we start building a ton of housing, we're never going to solve these problems. Like I said earlier, you know, we have about 700 people any given night staying in a shelter in Winnipeg, and until we build 700 units of transitional housing, that's not going to change very quickly, right? And so we're really working with the sector, but also advocating that the investment needs to come to really increase the level of, and we're really focused on the transitional supportive end of housing. There's a whole, you know, other end of housing that is, you know, very well needed as well, but that's not really our focus at Main Street Project. And we have to stop filling the gap of these crises with emergency services. You know, I think unfortunately our city deflects that they don't have a lot of responsibility and stuff, but they are responsible for emergency services, and they're choosing to invest, you know, in police over investing in community, right? So those are real conversations we like to have all the time. We need to do more to prevent housing loss. So the cheapest way to house people is to keep them where they're at, right? So those systems that are supposed to protect folks, like residential tenancies and things like that, need to have like be less bureaucratic and more kind of human based. And they need, if we can stop people from being homeless, then that's the best way to solve the work, right? And we saw, especially during the pandemic, that so many places closed their doors, and so many of that, what we classify as hidden homeless population that were couch surfing or crashing on, you know, hanging out in places they could, they got pushed out onto the street, and that's why we had to expand our shelters dramatically during that time. So really important that there's more of that eviction prevention, rent support stuff, you know, if it's as simple as, you know, just, you know, working with landlords to repair a door or a wall or, you know, something like that to keep someone housed, those should be where we're investing in solutions. Because, you know, if you're getting evicted because you damaged a wall when that could be fixed for a few hundred dollars, it's going to cost thousands of dollars if folks are coming through a shelter system or any other major system. And then, in terms of other solutions, we need to really take back a lot of the public investment that went into private housing stock. And this is you know, something we've seen across North America when the plans to end homelessness have been really successful, is they've been able to reclaim a lot of the public investment, you know, and look at things like rooming house, duplexes, triplexes have often got grants from government to fix up their spaces, but then they either, you know, after their 10-year, you know, loan guarantee or whatever, they either convert them to, you know, higher end housing or higher price housing, or they just, you know, or they raise the rents on them so they're no longer affordable. And I think a great example, you know, and we saw this in Medicine Hat a lot, which were one of the kind of Canadian cities that have claimed they've ended homelessness successfully, is they started buying up, not-for-profits started buying up these duplexes, triplexes, grooming house type units, and then bring them back into the public market where we know we can build in those social supports in a really good way. And so I think we've tried the model of giving the money all to the private sector and hoping they build housing that supports those who need it most. And I think we can say that's failed pretty badly. And so now taking that back, I think another really important thing is civic disruption. I think we don't hold our civic leaders as accountable. I think our city government, and I'm not trying to just bash the city government the whole time, but they pass the buck too often, and they have a very key role and a responsibility here. And unless we can get more of our city councilors and mayor on board with changing what homelessness looks like in Winnipeg, it's going to be a much harder journey for us to do that work. Harm reduction is super important. It's a core value for our organization and so many in the sector, but unfortunately we live in a place right now where it's very politicized, and so we try to take the politics out of the work, but politicians bring it back in because that's what they do, I guess. There's no harm reduction does not negate any access to recovery or treatment or any path towards recovery for folks out of addiction or problematic substance use. But the big thing harm reduction does is it meets people where they're at and gives them the tools to stay alive. And that's what we're really fighting right now is how to just keep people alive. You can't recover if you're dead. And so it's really important that we're always providing as many tools or all the tools needed to make sure people can recover or can eventually recover when they're ready for that in their life. And so we need things like safe consumption sites, we need managed alcohol programs, we need safe drug supply programs that are supported to change the way. Like if we invested in these, we could change the number of deaths in our city dramatically in a very short period of time. And then the last major solution I want to talk about is building community. So so often the work around poverty or the extreme ends of poverty or homelessness are kind of seen as like, oh, that's an agency responsibility. But this work happens if we would do it all together. It takes everybody to be part of the solution. It takes everybody to work on it. It takes everyone to come up with a local solution. Homelessness isn't a Higgins and Maine issue. It's the entire city of Winnipeg. And I can tell you that because I know where all the encampments are in the city, and they're not all downtown. And so it's a whole city issue, and the more we can build communities that are working together on solving these issues, and we get these calls all the time. We get calls, especially in the winter, because that's when most people are really concerned about people being outside in the cold, as we know the impacts of our winter. But people say, oh, there's someone at this bus shelter in St. James, what can we do? And I always say, where's your local library? Where's your local community center? Get together, open the doors, serve soup once a week, or provide those opportunities. Those can be provided anywhere, and it takes a small group of volunteers to do that stuff and doesn't cost any money, right? So so there's millions of solutions that can be done just by bringing community together to work as one, and considering the houseless or unsheltered folks part of your community is key, because they're not part of your community. It's whether you choose to accept them in your community and support them where you're at, and the best communities in the city and the world are ones that see all levels of incomes working together, living together, and growing and building together. So the more we can do that in every community, in every area, in every block in our city, the more successful we'll be at ending homelessness and some of these major social issues we're facing. Thanks.
Because the government is selling off housing selling off public housing, social housing, to private. Like, people are making luxury condos. I cannot get over 185 Smith Street. It happened, like, I don't know, 8 years ago. Like, it's all disappearing. And it's because the government's doing it. And I'm angry.
Yeah, you're right. It's true. 185 Smith is a great example. You look at that building now versus what it was, and you think about all the people that were displaced and where are they now. Most of them went into single room occupancy hotels like the Windsor, which just got shut down last month, and now those people are out on the street. And so, it's concerning. It is concerning the past. I think the government's changed their view on selling off the housing, and we've seen them commit to increasing the number of housing coming up, but promises are only as good as a promise until they follow through. So I think that's a really important point that it is the government's policy. You know, we haven't had a national housing strategy since 1994. So that's another key contributor to why we've seen such a lack of investment in housing as well, because the federal government isn't funding it in the levels they were. These things should be core functions of government, right? To house the people that need it most, to build the infrastructure that we need to do this stuff, and they're not doing it. So groups like ours are stepping up to do it, but we can't do it on the scale that's needed on our own. And the sector's really coming together, and we're trying to plan a lot better on how to collectively meet the housing needs and not let housing opportunities slip through the cracks. I know a great example is just recently, the pocket suites that were built as a pilot project in a number of neighborhoods were sold off from SAM management now, and then those units are all, two of the buildings have burned down, and that was a great community-based project that had great investment and provided a very, six units on one house slot, and was a great model, and just wasn't maintained or supported and let to kind of go in disrepair. And so these kind of things are great examples of where it wouldn't take a lot of intervention to save that housing if we see that investment before it gets to the point where they're no longer available for public housing.
Jamil, you mentioned a few times when you were talking about helping people where they are in place, that it's the best way to help someone if you can help them where they're at. And it got me thinking about infrastructure and social infrastructure in Winnipeg versus rural northern Manitoba. And I'm wondering if you have a perspective on funding and if we should see more social infrastructure in rural and northern Manitoba develop. Would that take some pressure on Winnipeg? Basically what I'm asking is, are people coming to Winnipeg because they don't have the infrastructure and supports in other communities where they're at, where their friends are?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some work to change that. I know some of our staff are actually going up to Thompson in May to support their transition from their shelter from a dry shelter to a more low barrier space. But I mean, I think their shelter is 10 spaces, right? So the size of supports in communities are very limited. I know Brandon's been expanding a little bit more recently, but even then the size isn't there to support the populations in those communities. And then we look at things like, flood and kind of those things that bring folks to the city as well. And how many folks who have come from, places like Lake St. Martin that are still evacuated into our city, just 4 or 5 years later, right? So definitely we see that flow of folks and coming to the city, especially around evacuations or those kind of things, and then getting stuck in the city and not being able to find those ways back home. And we're working on a few projects now with the AMC and other folks like that to how do we build those pathways back home for people and allow people to do that in a good way. And I think one of the reasons why some folks don't feel comfortable returning to their home communities is if they have a substance use issue or problematic substance use issue, they're way more stigma in their communities. And so how do we work to help them, get to a place where they can move back without stigma or build the education and knowledge within those communities so they can welcome them back? And we have great folks that work in our kind of Indigenous Relations Department through Truth and Reconciliation, and they talk a lot about how do we help people build their bundles back up so they can go back to their community holding their head up high and being happy to come back. And that's a lot of the work we're moving towards, and as we walk through a path of Truth and Reconciliation, is how do we support people in that way, in a healing way, and be that connection to healing. It's not like Main Street Project, you know, we're not an Indigenous organization, and this work should be led by the Indigenous organizations, but we can play a major role in being that connection piece, being that supporting piece, and then helping people connect into the right programs to support them do that work and return back home. Totally agree, Kamlyn. Also, you know, Kamlyn and I both have ran neighborhood renewal corporations in our past, and that's a really good example of another place where we've seen a divestment from our government. I don't think you'll ever see a better model than the neighborhood renewal corporation model that, you know, Spence Neighborhood Association, Daniel Mack Community Association, North End Community Renewal Corporation, right? Like those, that model is really what we should have in every single neighborhood. And, oh, sorry, I'll slow down. I got it. The model of neighborhood renewal corporations, which was basically allowing communities to build their own plans and then getting investment from the province to make those plans successful, you know, building housing, building community gardens, building, you know, youth and community programs in a really good holistic way and from the ground up, is an amazing model. Like it works so well, and we saw such amazing progress, and I'm not even sure where it's at right now. I know they have to fight for every dollar they get still, but there was a heyday there in the, you know, in the first start of the 2000s where we saw real big investment, and that impact is huge, and that's what shaped me as a person in working in that work in a lot of ways, and it was one of the most surprising things when I came to Main Street Project is seeing the how little community connecting work that happens in the Main and Higgins area, and how siloed a lot of the work was, and the need to kind of bring that building community model to the neighborhood, right? Like, you know, there's no block parties happening, there's no fun events, there's no street hockey in the streets, and all those things are so important to build the community up, and just because people are homeless doesn't mean they can't be part of that community, and so, but, you know, if you look at how even the Neighborhood Renewal Corporation model worked, it left a big gap in that area, right? And so we really need to make sure we look at these communities that are natural communities, like the community in the area is amazing, people take care of each other, you know, we have four major shelters in a very close proximity, and the community feel is there, but the investment in making that connection and support and resourcing it with things like, you know, art and sport and recreation and all these things that kind of we love, I love, that make me happy where I live, and we should do the same things in kind of those core areas of our city as well.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I imagine, and I'm kind of presupposing your answer here, but I imagine that you have a lot of issues dealing with staff turnover and the like. How do you keep your staff motivated to engage in such an important role?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I feel we're not on the worst end of what I've heard people are at in terms of turnover, but our work so hard. I think, you know, we have some realizations in our work. Like, we know that some people would only be able to last a year or two in shelter work. It's not a work that everyone can commit to longer term. It's very physically taxing, first of all, but also like the amount of vicarious trauma and that heart work that's so important is hard. So we do plan for like planned turnover. It's hard to say right now because during the pandemic we doubled our staffing to be able to do all the COVID response work we did. We moved our shelter 3 times to, you know, at the peak of the pandemic we had 260 shelter beds in the warehouse at 190 Disraeli, and we had 127 isolation units. So we really, like, we hired people during the hardest time to hire people, and no one wanted to work in public because we didn't know what was happening right in the pandemic. And so it's hard to tell where we're at in terms of our actual turnover rate versus like just the kind of slowing of the pandemic resource support and losing that. But it's a real, for us, our work, we try to connect it as much to our values as possible and our value work. And so our core values, you know, are harm reduction, trauma-informed, truth and reconciliation, and building agency sustainability, which is investing in our people that are there. And so we've really committed to really investing in training, but not just the core training. So we do all the core trainings, first aid, those kind of basic life savings, all that stuff. But it's a training around anti-oppression work and how that looks, and the truth and reconciliation work, and building our staff their own knowledge and education, and work around, you know, eliminating racism in our work, and all those things are what keep people wanting to stay with us. And so we really look at that, and we know every person that comes in, we're making an investment into them as a person, and that's really important value. We don't get it right all the time. You know, not everyone likes working there. Don't last long. That's the reality of the work. But when we can, we try to make that investment to build folks up. And then we also know that because we do a lot of different areas of work, we can move folks throughout our programming. So we actually just switched 4 months ago. So we now hire everybody through our shelter program. And that's their first 3 months of work is in shelter. And then they can move into like withdrawal management services, job or van outreach or other things like that. And that really sets a foundation for them to kind of do some of the hardest parts of our work as they start and learn our agency. But then we can also focus all of our training resources into one area versus trying to train everybody in 8 different areas in the same way. We found that was very hard, and that's where we lost more staff, is they didn't get that kind of value-based connection to our work as much when we were trying to spread it out through the whole organization. So centralizing that work has helped a little bit, but it's still too soon to tell based on whether some of the people, like our positions, have been just through kind of changes in the COVID funding we've received and versus what our kind of normal is. I don't know what normal is at all anymore, so I don't know if we'll get back to normal or not. But.
Hey, Jamil. Thank you for sharing your perspective. I really love what you bring to the vision of support, the understanding, the compassion and the humanity that you bring to it. I heard you talk a little bit about some of the things that you're evolving there in the short time that you've been there, around building community, around truth and reconciliation, working on our culture, team there, focus. I also see and observe and hear things evolving at Soul Mission. You talked about working with the group at Thompson to evolve the model as well. I wonder if you can share a bit of your philosophy, your perspective. What is it that the sector is moving toward, and why are those changes so important?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really lucky. Tessa Blakey Whitecloud is an amazing person, and to have her as the CEO of Silo Mission makes my job a lot easier. We get along really well. But also, I think that change of creating barriers for people to access the most important services, I think, and that's what we've seen with the transformation of Siloam. Siloam just recently moved to a behavior-based model versus an abstinence-based model, and so that's a huge change. That'll mean that people don't have to leave just because they're intoxicated, and that gives people more options in terms of where they can access emergency services and shelter and all the other services we offer. It's super important that we remove silos from the work and all work together. I consider everything we do a public investment, right? So anything we develop in terms of our work, I always think that's public domain. We should share that with everybody. We do lots of work with, you know, helping people write policies and giving. I've never written a policy from scratch. I always steal from other people, and I fully support people doing that all the time because it saves you a ton of time. And you get better when you look at what's existing, what's working, why it's not working, and then you can make your own based on your organizational value and make that work. So yeah, I think it's important to look at changing the culture of some of this work. You know, bringing anti-oppression and anti-racism work into Mainstream Project wasn't easy. It's still not easy. We're just starting that path. Like, it's been, you know, about a year and a half of really trying to look at that. And we've had opposition from some of our staff internally. It's a different way of thinking of work. A lot of people, you know, and we found this when we were doing our strategic planning, is that some people come into the work because they want to save everybody, right? And it's like often based on, you know, that religious approach to the work, and there's nothing wrong with that approach. The work we do is about the relation with a person, and it shouldn't matter, you know, like, you shouldn't be there as a savior, right? That's not you're not going to do good. You're going to actually cause more harm in that work, and you're going to actually put yourself at more risk, right, in terms of how you relate to people. And so seeing the shift in this sector of people really framing how people should be doing the work and how they should come into the work is really, it's game-changing, I think, for that approach. And it doesn't change if you have faith or not or where you're at in that. It just means that you're not, you know, thrusting that upon anybody or requiring that as part of a service. And those changes really, really open the doors for people to feel more connected and supported and feel good in those spaces. And you see the changes within physical spaces just from that kind of value-based changes. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Thanks, and we just wanted to also express thanks, as Kim was saying, just the awareness and the information, just the overarching breadth of supports that you and the team provide to folks that are in such need across our city. You know, the work that obviously the Mainstream Project does and the team is in the field. You know, it meets people where they're at. You know, similarly to Jubilee, I think, the report talks about helping 20 individuals through the Rent Guarantee Program. This is real people behind the numbers, right? Meeting with C. Winnipeg, helping newcomers, you know, get into a job that pays higher income so they can afford more decent housing. Even that is frontline meeting people where they're at. So for all of that, I commend and encourage all of you to continue that. My question is, you talk about 700. In any given night, there's 700 people potentially sleeping in shelters. Can you paint us a picture? How has the face of that 700 changed? Or has it changed over the years, pre- and post-pandemic, or even the work that you've done before the years that you've joined the Mainstream Project? Just give us a sense of who these people are.
Yeah, I think, you know, pre-pandemic, I think the shelter bed number was, you know, probably 350, 400, I think. I don't have an exact number, but I think that's probably what the shelter system held before the pandemic. And so we've seen an investment. You know, we expanded our space from a 75-mat facility on Martha Street to 120-bed facility in the Mitchell Fabrics building. 190 Disraeli became the Dinnowaymack, the Indigenous-led shelter. Really great model there for how they're supporting folks. But the face, what we saw in the pandemic was really big, is the hidden homeless face is women, it's 2S LGBTQ plus folks, it's trans folks, right? It's the people that would often put themselves in vulnerable situations to stay off the street. But when the pandemic hit, that changed a lot, and people weren't able to, you know, even if they weren't good places to crash, they weren't able to crash there anymore because, you know, the contact with people letting people in their homes, those kind of things really changed a lot with all the restrictions and stuff. And so we saw a huge influx of folks, especially women. Our previous pre-pandemic shelter had 10 to 12 spots for women, you know, in a small back room at Martha Street. And when we expanded to the 190 Disraeli during the pandemic while we were renovating the Mitchell Fabrics building, we saw our women's space go from the 10 or 12 to 65 to 70 beds needed, because we had a dedicated space on their own floor separate from the main shelter area. And I think that's the other big problem is shelters in general were designed only with like single men as their main target group, right? Or that. So we're really seeing as we do this work in a different way, the need for adaptations of services. Obviously, like a city like Winnipeg should have a dedicated women's shelter. We don't have that, right? Like we have domestic violence shelters, but we don't have a dedicated women's homeless shelter, right? And there's a great strategy West Central Women's Resource Center put together. I always get the name wrong. It's Closing the Circle or Closing the Gap. It's something like that. It's a gender based homelessness strategy that was meant to augment the end homelessness strategy. And that really presents a lot of the framework of how we need to work. But it's changed quite a bit in terms of that. And it's not just, you know, shelter bed per se, it's all services. You know, we offer withdrawal management services, but we know that while we allow folks who are non-binary into both of our facilities based on how they identify, we also know that the majority of folks who are trans or non-binary don't feel safe coming into those spaces in general, right? There's so much, they're congregate living environments, they're pretty small because we have limited resources. And so they're not great spaces. So we know that folks in the trans community are withdrawing from substances by locking themselves in their friends' basements and things like that. So we've been working a lot with groups like Sunshine House and having walkthroughs of our spaces to identify how we can improve our safety for folks and identifying what those needs are. And same with our shelter spaces, right? Like we have groups of peer-led groups come in and identify where are spaces that feel unsafe, because you can do as much planning as you want from the operator's perspective, but until people are in those spaces and living, you don't know what the manifestation of safety looks like for folks. And so we do a lot of work for that, and a lot of it's like identifying where we're failing in those areas and then identifying where we need the resources to expand or grow or develop their own, right? Like we should have a trans withdrawal unit, right? Like that should be an independent thing, but you know, a lot of it comes down to the continued lack of resources that are provided to everybody in the not-for-profit sector. But I think the homeless and addiction sector probably has seen the least amount of investment until this last year or two, where we've seen kind of a little bit of a more of a commitment from the provincial government at least.
I know you have other questions. You can tap in and more questions.
Thank you.
Can we just show our picture?